I'm happy to finally visit UC Davis. I've been in California many times, but never quite made it up here. So as Joe mentioned, I'll try to give you some flavor of where we stand today with simulating QCD, quantum chromodynamics, and the real QCD, namely, including the feedback from light quark flavors, which has been a challenge for lattice QCD for many years. Lattice QCD was formulated almost immediately after it became clear that QCD was a good candidate series for a strong interaction. And so that was in the early 70s. Wilson, who formulated this first theory, his seminal paper came out in 74. And then it was only 5 years later that the first numerical works came out that was pioneered by Mike Kreutz, who introduced Monte Carlo important sampling techniques to the simulation of QCD systems. But all those early simulations always neglected the influence of quarks. And so what I will tell you a little bit about is the advances that we've made that now allow realistic simulations of quantum chromodynamics. So the work that I've been doing was done in with the Milk collaboration. And this is a picture of some of the cast. There are several senior people included. Steve Gottlieb from the University of Indiana, Claude Bernard from St. Louis, Washington University, Carlton Dittar, who is at Utah, Bob Sugar, Santa Barbara, who is we're very grateful to have because he's the one that has most of the contacts with the funding agency. He does all, coordinates all our many, many proposal writing for computer time. Basically, we write about 5 or 6 proposals a year just to get computer time and so on. And Dr. Sam from Tucson, Jim Hedrick, who is has been for several years now at the closest to you, actually. He's at Pacific University in Stockton. And then there is a revolving cast of postdocs and graduate students. So that was picture was taken, I think, 3 years ago, roughly. So I'll give a brief outline of the talk. I'll tell you a little bit about the choices that we have to make before we start doing simulations and what they mean. I'll give you a brief summary of the highlights of what has been achieved by doing these full QCD simulations compared to what we did before when we neglected the feedback from internal quark loops. And then I'll show in somewhat more detail some of our precision results in one particular sector, in the pseudoscalar meson sectors, where we can compute a decay constant, which then lead also to determination of quark masses and so on. Probably I'll have to speed up by then, and I'll give you just a little bit of a flavor of some other computations of phenomenological interest that one can do. We can compute heavy light decay constants, form factors for semileptonic B and D meson decays, and those are theoretical inputs that are needed to analyze, for example, experimental results from the B factories to extract fundamental parameters of the standard model that we all are interested in. And then I'll end with a summary and some outlook. So lattice QCD, what we start off is we have, of course, continuum space-time. We discretize space-time and represent that by a grid of lattice points that are separated by some lattice spacing, which is denoted by A. Now, in a serially like QCD, when we do a simulation, we don't actually tell the computer we want to have a lattice spacing of 0.1 Fermi. What we give the computer is a bare coupling constant, the gauge coupling constant, and by the property of dimensional transmutation that QCD has, that determines a posteriori what the lattice spacing is. So what we're dialing in on the computer is the gauge coupling, the bare gauge coupling, and from that we get the lattice spacing. What we also determine, of course, is the grid size, and therefore the physical volume, and then we can dial in the bare quark masses. And in the setup that we're computing, we take the up and down quark masses that we simulate with as degenerate. So that's the isospin symmetric limit. But we keep the strange quark mass separate and more heavy. Now, even with today's powerful computers and the algorithmic improvements that the field has undergone over the last 10 years, we still cannot simulate at completely physical parameters. And so we have to take several limits. Well, the first limit, of course, we have to take is we're not interested in lattice QCD. We're interested in continuum QCD. So we have to take the limit of the lattice spacing going to zero. We also are not really interested usually in finite volume QCD. We're interested in infinite volume QCD. So we have to take the infinite volume limit. And finally, the computations become quickly very more expensive when we decrease the masses of the light quarks. So far we have not been able to simulate really at the physical quark masses for the light, for the up and down quark. So we have to make some extrapolations in the light quark masses. The strange quark mass is heavy enough that we can comfortably simulate at the physical quark mass, or really interpolate to it, because in the what we have to do is we have to make a guess of what the bare quark, strange quark mass is before we start the simulation, and then we don't always hit it right on spot, but we're within a few 10% or so of the physical strange quark mass. When one discretizes a continuum field theory on the lattice, there is not a unique way of discretizing. So there are many different ways that one can discretize an action on the lattice. So we have to make a choice there too. And our choice is to use a so-called improved action, which is not quite the most naive discretization, but one that makes the lattice spacing effects, the order a squared effects, smaller. So we try to minimize those a priori. This is not a completely straightforward undertaking for a quantum theory as we want to simulate. If you just want to solve partial differential equation, you can quite easily improve the way you take derivatives so that your finite grid errors there are not of order, say, a squared, but you can, by having next nearest neighbor interactions, you can make them of order a to the 4. However, in a quantum field theory, basically by via quantum effects, even so, you might naively think, well, I have only a to the 4 error. Quantum fluctuations introduce back order a squared errors with some coupling constant maybe in front of it. So improving the action is a somewhat more difficult procedures for QCD simulations, but several years' work has improved. You understand much better what is going on there too. The next choice that we have to do is we have to choose a fermion action. And I don't really want to be very technical here, because I could talk for an hour just about that. Fermions turn out to be the most difficult things when we discretize field theory on the lattice. Bosons are much easier to discretize. One of the things that happens if you just take the Dirac equation and replace the derivative by a finite difference to put one fermion on the lattice, what you actually end up with is not with one fermion, but with two to the space-time dimension. So for us, 2^4, 16 fermions, that's a well-known fermion doubling problem. And there are very various ways of, and we don't, of course, want to simulate a world with 16 light quarks, or so we only have two light quarks. So we need to circumvent that doubling problem. There are various ways of doing that. One of them is the so-called staggered scheme, where by a clever rearrangement of the degrees of freedom, one can reduce the doubling problem from having 16 kinds of fermions per fermion that you actually want to put on to only have four. But you still have a fourfold degeneracy with which one wants to lift. And the advantage of this scheme is that it's computationally by far the cheapest fermionic scheme. There are other schemes where one gives these extra species heavier masses, but they have some bad properties. There's a very important property of QCD with light quarks is chiral symmetry. And if you want to lift these degeneracies, you actually break chiral symmetry explicitly. So you have to do a fine-tuning to get back to a chiral symmetric theory. So our choice was to use the fermion that is cheap to simulate and live with the drawbacks. One of the drawbacks is that we have to take, since we still, in essence, simulate with four times too many fermions, we have to reduce that by hand. Goes under the name of this fourth root trick for the fermion determinant. And this trick is somewhat controversial still today. We believe that there are no problems associated with this approach for results when extrapolated to the continuum limit. But it's so far somewhat of an open question. It's, as I said, I could talk much more about this technical problem, but I don't think that's what I want to go to. Just I want to expand a little bit more on this so-called doubling problem. When we put these staggered fermions on the lattice, as I said, it acts like we have four kinds of fermions instead of one. But at finite lattice spacings, these fermions are actually not completely degenerate. They have splittings between them which are supposed to vanish when we take the continuum limit. And here I show an illustration of these splittings. Here on the right-hand plot here, I show that the splittings are independent of the quark mass for a given lattice spacing. So when we simulate with a given lattice spacing, the splittings, the differences between these lines here, they're independent, so the lines are parallel. The left-hand plot shows that the splittings, so what is shown here is the meson mass minus the smallest one in a log plot versus the square of the lattice spacing, that they actually do vanish as we expect them to, namely as the power of a squared. This, the line here that I draw, is just the line corresponding to the way we expect these splittings to vanish. So when we go to the continuum limit, these masses all become degenerate. And that's one of the conditions that has to happen if this fourth root trick becomes really a valid procedure in the continuum limit.
So the right plot is for...
That's a fixed lattice spacing as a function of the quark mass.
How many Fermi? Huh? How many Fermi?
This one was done on an ensemble with 0.12 Fermi lattice spacing. So that would correspond to this data set. Oops. So Milk has been doing these simulations for 5 or 6 years by now, I guess. And most of the results that I will show you will have used three different lattice spacings, around 0.12 Fermi, 0.09 Fermi, and 0.06 Fermi. And for each lattice spacing, we have simulated with many different quark masses, usually three to five different light quark masses and one or two different strange quark masses. To control finite volume effects, our experience is that one needs a box that is at least 2 Fermi across for the type of quantity that we want to compute. So all our volumes are at least 2.4 Fermi across. We have some that are bigger to check for finite volume effects. The finite volume effects are also strongly dependent on the Compton wavelengths of the lightest particle, the pion, and all our systems are such that the Compton wavelengths is at most a quarter of the lattice size. As I mentioned before, we simulate at various is what the quark masses are in a different scheme that goes under the name of MSR mass. And there is a conversion factor, so-called renormalization constant, that converts our bare lattice numbers into this more common MSR number. And so here, this conversion has been done, and in this case we have then one more column of error. Let's see, this column here, where this error comes from this conversion, from the uncertainty in this conversion factor. Again, I should point out that both here, the value for the up quark mass is significantly away from zero. That has a significance. There is a problem with strong interactions that goes under the name of strong CP problem. And one of the solutions, I can't explain really what that strong CP problem is, but one of the possible solution of the strong CP problem would be if the one of the quark, the up or the down quark mass, and since the up quark mass is lighter, if the up quark mass were zero, now our result tells you that we find that the up quark mass is non-zero by about something like 10 standard deviations. So this one proposal for solving this so-called strong CP problem is not a viable solution. Besides the quark masses, the pseudo-scalar masses, we can also compute the decay constant of the pion and the kaon, and in particular also their ratio, which is shown here, and compare them to the to the numbers that one finds in, for example, in the particle data group book. Now, it should be emphasized that to actually get these experimental numbers, one needs to have some input. One of the inputs that one needs for that is a knowledge of what goes under the name of Kopiebo angle. Now, the Kopiebo angle can be measured in different processes, and what the particle data book does is it takes the Kopiebo angle, measured in some different ways, and then uses experimental data to get f pi and fk. But one can turn it around. One can take experimental data on the ratio of the decay fraction of a kaon going to a lepton and the nu divided by the decay fraction of a pi going to the lepton and nu. So take that from experiment. Take fk of f pi from theory, for example, from our lattice theory, and then use that to extract a number for the Kopiebo angle. And if we do that, then we get that the Kopiebo angle, or the CKM matrix element VUS, we get this value here. And we can compare that with the world average quoted in the particle data group book. And we see that the results are consistent, and the errors are actually comparable. So using just lattice as an input, lattice as the theory input, plus some experimental data, we can now reproduce some of the data in the particle data book with precision comparable to the best available with other methods. There are some other low energy constants in this effective theory that one can extract. The numbers all come out very reasonable. We can, of course, compute not only pion and masses, we also can compute nucleon masses and extrapolate those to light quarks and the continuum. That's a little bit more tricky, and we have not spent quite as much time. I will show you at the end the ballpark, and the ballpark figures come out good, but not with the same precision as we have in the pseudoscalar meson sector. That's the omega minus pi. I want to spend a few minutes explaining other things that we can compute on the lattice that is of phenomenological interest. That has to do with the weak interaction, electroweak interaction, and the so-called Kabiba Kobayashi Naskawa matrix that governs the electroweak interactions. The upshot there is that the quarks, mass eigenstate of the quarks are not the eigenstates of quarks that are diagonal in the interaction, and that the quark sector is mixed. So the weak interaction current in the lepton sector is just diagonal. Electron neutrino goes with the electron and so on. Now, whereas in the quark sector, there is a mixing that mixes the downstrangent bottom quark respective to the up charm and top quark. This mixing matrix, Kawibo Kobayashi Maskawa matrix, is the matrix elements are parameters of the standard model, and there is a strong experimental effort to determine those parameters from experiments. Now, it turns out that there is theoretical input from lattice QCD is needed to extract some of these parameters from experiment. For example, the decay rate, the branching fraction of a B meson decaying into a lepton and a neutrino goes schematically through a diagram like this. The B meson at some point annihilates, spits out the W plus boson, which then, for example, decays into tau plus and tau and the corresponding neutrino. Now, this part of this diagram is an electroweak diagram. Electroweak is a very weakly interacting theory, so we can compute that in perturbation theory. However, what is in the box here, which is parameterized by the decay constant of the B meson, that's a non-perturbative QCD matrix element that we have to somehow compute. And lattice QCD can do the computation of this decay constant. And so then, having measured this branching fraction and knowing the masses and some kinematical factors that are known, if we know FB, we can then extract this matrix CKM matrix element VUB. There are several. Let me not go into it. So this is a computation that can be done with these gauge configurations that we have generated, and we have done such a computation. Just one result here. It's a ratio of two of these decay constants. Ratios are easier because a lot of systematic errors go fall out, but just to show you that we can measure these things, and we can actually get out numbers. And so using the ensemble that we have created, we can predict these, or can determine these decay constants. Now, it turns out that these decay constants, when we first produced these numbers, that was about two years ago, was just before the first experimental results were announced from Clio on these decay constants. So those were actually predictions from the lattice, not postdictions. And you can see that the numbers agree fairly well within the errors. The errors are comparable errors to the experiment currently. One can also deal fairly easily on down here, which needs to be computed on the lattice, and what one can parameterize this part here in terms of two so-called form factors, because the result here depends on how much momentum the W carries away. There are two form factors, and these can be computed on the lattice. And my collaboration has done that again. This is a sample result of form factor for B2 pi dk. So we can compute on the lattice yet the whole momentum range, but we have a fairly large momentum range. Then we can parameterize the form factor to make extrapolations. This is for the B meson. For the D, we can actually cover a much larger range. And for the D semileptonic decays, there are experimental results that we can compare with, which I've done here. There is a result by the Focus collaboration, which has computed the momentum dependence of the form factor, but not the absolute normalization. So they normalized the form factor at zero. We've shown you that the points here, the error bars are the experimental results, and the continuous curve is the lattice result after parameterizing the form factor, and then but on here the difference in mass is much less, so it's easier. I mean, we don't have exactly all the way down to, I mean, some of it is just, and you use a dipole parameterization or parameterization for the form factor to get the actual continuous curve. But so knowing this, the form factor, and knowing partial differential decay rate of these semileptonic decays, from experiment again, one can again use that information then to extract some of the relevant CKM matrix elements. And going through this exercise, so again, again, the input here being some experimental data plus our lattice results as the only theory, we can get numbers for VUB, VCD, VCS, and VCB to some precision, which we hope to improve, of course, in the future. There's an entire row of the CKM matrix element that we can actually determine, so we can check whether the the CKM matrix is unitary to our precision, and it's almost too good within the error, but so far we certainly see no indication that the CKM matrix is not non-unitary. So let me stop here so that we have some time for question. I'm trying to give you some feel for that we've made progress in simulations with fully 2 plus 1 flavor QCD, where we've finished our simulations at two lattice spacings. We have one lattice spacing.